music radio free. You see blue skies and think of sea. How are you doing? And later on, switch on TV. They give me a news, they give half truths to me. They give us wires, they feed us lies. How are we doing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Educate, they fabricate. And we sit back till it's too late.
The Radio Avenger.
Rick Adams is on.
Hello, everyone, ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages. Rick Adams is with you today on this Saturday excursion to the world of reality. And today is the 30th of March, 2019. Man, we made it so far. Tomorrow's the last day of the month, and we start in April, God willing. You know, today I'm going to have, as I mentioned last week, special guest and a good friend and someone who I could honestly say is a scholar in his own right. And, you know, we have a lot of scholars on these programs that you won't find on conventional radio talk nature, as they call it. And he is Tom Kimmel. And I'm going to say a few words, as I always do customarily, before I begin from the scripture, because I think it's most important to set the tone of what we talk about, you know. The most important thing is bringing forth truth. Truth is a precious commodity today, as we know. And in the scriptures, we're told, right in the book of Psalms, in Psalm 101 and verse 7, we're told that he who practices deceit will not dwell in my house. No one who speaks falsely will stand in my house. Fence. You know, that's echoed throughout the scriptures. Deceit, lying, cheating, dishonesty, corruption, especially when it costs innocent lives. And then I look at, you know, Solomon's Proverbs, and I read in Proverbs, you know, in the English language, of course, in the New English Version of the Bible, and it'll suffice that, as we know, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord. But those who act faithfully are his delight. And that comes from Proverbs chapter 12, verse 22. These are the words which I really hearken to bring about the foreword to this program today, because I've invited Thomas K. Kimmel, who, as you know, is no stranger to these programs, is the grandson, the great-grandson of Admiral Kimmel, at Pearl Harbor. And we know that story quite well here. For those of you who don't, you'll hear about it today again. And the fact of the matter is, Tom has, you know, he's accomplished quite a bit. He's worked as a veteran for the FBI for many years. He was in the Naval Academy, of course, graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. He has a distinguished career. His family has also been distinguished, as I just mentioned, with husband E. Kimmel. And he was invited by me today to do a special program on what role, how major a role, did the Soviet Union, the Soviet Red Army, and the Soviet Secret Intelligence have over the Churchill administration in Britain, the Japanese, and others, as well as, and most important of all, the Roosevelt administration in Washington, leading up to Pearl Harbor. Now, Tom said, I'll do it, Rick. He said, provided we can tie it all in to Pearl Harbor. And that's exactly what we intend to do, the road to war. And here he is. Welcome back, Tom Kimmel. Rick Adams, how are you, sir? Welcome back, Tom.
And your scripture citing immediately made me think of a talk I gave at William & Mary College where they critiqued me, the whole audience wrote in critiques. And one of the critiques that resonated with me which is pertinent to your scripture starting the show, was a criticism of me because I spent all of one of my lectures up there describing all of the officials Pearl Harbor related that lied under oath. And the criticism was I should have spent some time describing what it was that Kimmel and his staff did to try and get this information that they never got. And yes. Since I have been unable to respond to that person in the audience, let me take just a moment here to tell you, because I know you've never heard this before, tell you what Kimmel and his staff did to try and get this information. Obviously, they failed, and the information I'm talking about is the information that our spies were able to obtain through the decoding of Japanese diplomatic and spy communications in a program called MAGIC. And, of course, the real definition of MAGIC is the American effort to decode any Japanese coded material.
Mm-hmm.
The first time Kimmel heard about the fact that maybe he wasn't getting the information that he thought he should be getting, he wrote a letter to his boss, the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Stark. And this was his first appeal to Chief of Naval Operations Stark for information. It took place 18 days after Kimmel took command of the Pacific Fleet. That would be February 18th, 1941. And Kimmel pens these words: I have recently been told by an officer fresh from Washington, that would be Admiral Brown, that the Office of Naval Intelligence considers it the function of operations to furnish me, the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific, with information of a secret nature. I have heard also that operations considers the responsibility for furnishing the same type of information to be that of naval intelligence. I do not know that we've missed anything out here in the Pacific, Admiral Stark, but if there's any doubt as to whose responsibility it is to keep me, the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific, fully informed of pertinent reports on subjects that should be of interest to the fleet, will you kindly fix that responsibility so there will be no misunderstanding?
Mm-hmm.
Two weeks later, Stark comes back and says, with reference to your postscript on the subject of responsibility for furnishing of secret information to you, Captain Kirk, the head of the Office of Naval Intelligence, is fully aware of his responsibility in keeping you adequately informed. That was Kimmel's first effort to get information. The second effort was in June of 1941, when Kimmel wrote another letter and hand-delivered it to Stark in Washington, D.C., in which he said, it is suggested that it be made a cardinal principle that the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific be immediately informed of all important developments as they occur by the quickest secure means available. That was the second appeal to Stark. The third appeal to Stark by Kimmel was made on the 26th of July, to which Stark made the perfunctory reply, if you do not get as much information as you think you should get, Admiral Kimmel, the answer probably is that particular situation which is uppermost in our mind has just not gelled sufficiently for us to give you anything authoritative. A fourth effort for Kimmel trying to get information out of Stark, armed with copies of Admiral King's shoot-on-sight operation orders — Admiral King was the head of our forces in the Atlantic — armed with copies of King's shoot-on-sight orders given after the 4 September USS Greer event, Kimmel approached Stark on 12 September with a fourth appeal for information. What about the Pacific? Kimmel asked. Stark's reply was made a subject of his interrogation during the Naval Court of Inquiry in 1944. You, Admiral Stark — this is the question by the Naval Court of Inquiry, intended to indicate to Admiral Kimmel that you would keep him fully and promptly informed as to all diplomatic developments which you learned, at least, from the Secretary of State. Stark's reply was, that's right. Indeed, Stark wrote to Kimmel on August 22, 1941, that, "You may rest assured, Admiral Kimmel, that as soon as I, Admiral Stark, get anything of definite interest, I shall fire it along." Thus, Stark told Kimmel both that the Office of Naval Intelligence would keep him informed, and that he personally would keep Kimmel informed. But in the event, neither kept him informed. Now, it doesn't end there. Pacific Fleet Intelligence Officer Eddie Layton's appeal to the Office of Naval Intelligence Arthur McCallum for information is terribly important. Eddie Layton was Kimmel's intelligence officer, and later he was Nimitz's intelligence officer for the entire war. Eddie Layton says Kimmel was justifiably uneasy despite Washington's assurances. He repeatedly asked me whether I thought that we were receiving all the diplomatic intelligence available to Washington, and I agreed to make my own personal efforts to find out. On 11 March 1941, I penned a personal letter for hand delivery by courier to my former boss and old associate from the Tokyo Embassy, Commander Arthur McCallum, who was the head of the Far East section of the Office of Naval Intelligence. I took the matter up directly with my opposite number in the Navy Department. I frankly expressed my concern that Kimmel's belief that we were being shortchanged on diplomatic intelligence, and urged him to make sure that he sent us intercepted Japanese traffic on a regular basis. As the political situation with Japan was becoming increasingly tense, I also suggested to McCallum that Station Hypo, which is Hawaii, be allowed to retain two of its most experienced Japanese language officers. More than a month went by before I received his Dear Eddie letter. McCallum gave what amounted to a stinging, formal brush-off to both my requests. Washington, he maintained, was responsible for evaluating the political situation and matters of security, which would be very difficult to solve, made it impractical to send us diplomatic intercepts. As he put it, "I should think that forces afloat should in general confine themselves to the estimates of the strategic and tactical situations with which they will be confronted when the time of action arrives." Yeah. Material, sure, you mentioned can necessarily have but passing and transient interest, as action in this political sphere is determined by the government as a whole and not by the forces afloat. This ends it. Washington's decision, the diplomatic intelligence was none of Pearl Harbor's business, was to have fatal repercussions 8 months later. And this last note, Rick. Senator Ferguson of the Joint Congressional Committee interrogating Admiral Layton, the Fleet Intelligence Officer. Senator Ferguson, and you did believe up until the time of the attack that you were getting all diplomatic intercepted messages that would in any way relate to the action of the fleet? Layton, I thought that the department had sent us everything they had, and when I learned a couple of years later that we had been shortchanged, I was outraged and astonished. Keep in mind, the Washington High Command, Marshall, Stark, Giroux, Turner, Miles, and Wilkinson, they told the Roberts Commission that Kimmel and Short in Hawaii had the same information in Hawaii as they had in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Rick. That ends my little spiel on what Kimmel and his staff tried to do to get the information.
And to no avail, I might add, too. It seems the forces that were running the show were determined to have somebody be a fall guy for this backdoor attempt at war. And this is why I asked you, how could the propaganda, the major influence, not only in these governments, but more importantly, even in the media at that time? And I think, quite honestly, going back now, we had a little bit more integrity, a little bit more honesty in the media at the time because there was more independence than now. Now it's just a Roman circus. But at that time. Even so, we know the Soviet Union, based on the Venona intercepts and other historical writings, indeed had people working in the media. I mean, they had people who were either willing or unwilling, fellow travelers, if you will, some perhaps members of the Communist Party. They were in Hollywood, we know that, making propaganda movies in the 30s and so forth. But I asked you to come on because I never realized until recently just how extensive this campaign, this, if you will, this procedure, this program to enable these puppet governments of Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt to be able to actually wend Americans into a sense of being threatened. And, you know, it wasn't working, as you know, psychologically. The campaign of fear and the White Committee that Roosevelt had impaneled, all these scholars and experts and so on, so on and so forth, warning the American people that if we didn't get involved in the war on the side of Russia, then we would be doomed. That didn't work, and the American people weren't buying it. So it would require some kind of attack directly on American installation. But as the Secretary of War said, I believe it was him in his diaries, we don't want it to be too big an attack, but just enough to get the American public involved in a war. And that was a treasonous admission in and of itself. But be that as it may, how big, and I'm looking at some of the key players, the Soviet agents in all the governments, including in Japan, which had full diplomatic relations with Russia, but how big an influence in the United States, in this country, and in Britain in particular, did the Soviet agents and apparatus have in bringing about the kind of psychological conditioning and deliberate acts of treachery to precipitate a Pearl Harbor? How large?
Well, of course, I speak on this subject not infrequently. And I like to start with this idea of treason, because that's what we're talking about. Treason is at the core of all of this. So I usually like to start with a quotation from Cicero, 42 B.C., if you will. A nation can survive its fools and even the ambitious, but it cannot survive treason from within.
Right.
An enemy at the gates is less formidable, for he is known and carries his banner openly. But the traitor moves amongst those within the gate freely, his sly whispers rustling through all the alleys, heard in the very halls of government itself. A murderer is less to fear. Now, I think that's pretty good, but I like to follow it up with probably the fellow who gave us the greatest insight into the Soviet penetration of this country. And as far as I know, he was the first to do so. And I'm talking about Whitaker Chambers. Mm-hmm. He certainly knew what he was talking about.
Yes.
Most of this treason is thought of as the traditional spying idea, as opposed to somebody who's just in a position to cause havoc. And Whitaker Chambers, in his autobiography, William F. Buckley called it the best autobiography ever written, Whitaker Chambers says, that power to influence policy has always been the ultimate purpose of the Communist Party's infiltration. It's a terribly important sentence. The power to influence policy has always been the ultimate purpose of the Communist Party's infiltration. It was much more dangerous and, as events have proved, much more difficult to detect than espionage, which beside it is trivial. Oh, the two go hand in hand.
Wow. All right, let's take a break on that note. We've got our first break, Tom. We'll come right back with you and the role of the Soviet agents in the Pearl Harbor attack. Folks, Rick Adams, Uncensored.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Don't feel like the Lone Ranger. You've got the Radio Avenger on your side.
Hey, Rick Adams is on. Hey, turn your horse radio on. Rick Adams is on. Ouch.
Well, we're back now with Thomas K. Kimmel. Tom, I'd like you to continue in what you were just describing for us from the words of Cicero. And how it relates to Washington.
Well, I'm certainly going to have to go right to the Harry Dexter White episode because...
Yeah. I was just reading about him again. Him and Popoff and a whole host of others looking it up. There's so many different websites and news sources that are pretty good in describing how vast the secret network was. But, let's go to Harry Dexter White and the Treasury Department.
Well, of course, Harry Dexter White was the fair-haired boy of the Treasury Department. And as a fair-haired boy, he became terribly influential. And I usually like to start this off with a quote from a United Kingdom historian, Andrew Robertshaw, who was trying to grapple with the question of why Kimmel has not been advanced, why modern American presidents refuse to see Kimmel reinstated to his original rank. And he opined that that basically it's because it's such a stain on American history.
Mm-hmm.
You risk reopening the case against the president at the time, FDR. So going back and looking at it again is dangerous. Of course, this makes me ask the question, dangerous, how so? Well, clearly, it's dangerous because you risk unmasking Soviet espionage in President Roosevelt's administration. So, how do you stop that? Well, you keep the focus on Kimmel and General Short, the head of the Army Hawaiian Command at Pearl Harbor, away from Pearl Harbor-related Soviet espionage, actual or suspected, in the Roosevelt administration by Harry Dexter White, Launchlin Curie, who was an assistant to President Roosevelt, Harry Hopkins, who many thought was the alternative president, and many others, as revealed by Venona. And not only that, you risk unmasking Pearl Harbor deficiencies, which were caused by Lend-Lease. And of course, Lend-Lease was controlled by Harry Hopkins, the alternative president.
Mm-hmm.
And nominally by Admiral Reeves, who was a member of the Roberts Commission, of all things.
Oh, what a coincidence.
Yeah. Also, you risk unmasking the collusion, love that word, in the engineering official of an official thesis of guilt against Admiral Kimmel and General Short. And then finally, you expose how Kimmel and Short were manipulated into retirement against their will.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the big one is Harry Dexter White and the Soviets' effort to compromise him, which was hugely successful, of course, and began in the 1930s when a famous illegals officer, Ikshak Akhmerov, compromised Harry Dexter White. And this caused the Soviets, when Harry Dexter White received his lofty position in the Treasury Department, knowing full well that the Secretary of the Treasury, Morgenthau, had great sway over foreign policy, much to the annoyance of the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull. Roosevelt would refer to his dear friend, Henry Morgenthau. Well, yeah. Henry Morgenthau was not considered the brightest bulb on the tree, so he deferred to an admittedly very bright bulb, Harry Dexter White. And the Soviets, they knew this. So the Soviets, they tried to parlay off of this, and they arranged a meeting with a KGB officer, actually an NKVD officer in those days.
Time.
Mm-hmm. And Vitaly Pavlov was the man selected, and they decided they would give an opportunity to this KGB or this NKVD officer to go meet with Harry Dexter White and see if they couldn't influence American foreign policy. And, of course, what the Soviets wanted was to ensure that the Japanese attacked the Dutch, the British, and the Americans south and did not attack the Soviets to the north, which would have been disastrous for the Soviets at the time. So they had a special meeting, in Washington, D.C., at the old Ebbets Grill.
All right. We'll take another break now. We'll get back to dinner at the grill. And we'll come back with Thomas K. Kimmel, folks. Fascinating story. This is real history before your ears. Rick Uncensored.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds, up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AirOutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AROutfitting.com.
Tired of being lied to by mass media?
Many people tell us about their experience with Extendivite. Just listen to what Glenn has to say.
Prior to taking it, I had diabetic neuropathy. The Extendivite reduced that significantly. Acid reflux was reduced. I had athlete's foot, very severe. Trimmed that down to about 75% dandruff. Almost completely gone. I had occipital neuralgia at the base of my skull. I was having migraines reduced by about 90%. Heart palpitations, my heart would kind of stall out. I would skip a beat. Very uncomfortable. And when walking from downstairs going to sleep, by the time I got to the bedroom, which is just one flight of stairs, my heart was pounding, coming out of my chest. My vision was blurry. This completely solved that problem. Great product. Thanks.
Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
See, the vigilantes are a mob. These badges make us legal. We're the law. And the law has the right to shoot up a mob.
All right. Okay, we're back now, and we're going to go to Din Din now with all these key figures led by the Pavlov Soviet agent in Washington. So let's see, what were they doing there at that meeting, at that grill, Tom? They weren't just munching on food and having a good time, were they?
They were not. They were carrying out carefully crafted orders from Moscow Center to do their best to convince Harry Dexter White to continue a hardline American policy against Japan. We had virtually brought Japan to its knees through a whole series of economic moves. Most notable was we cut off their oil.
Yep. That's an act of war in and of itself.
Well, the one that really gets to me, you don't hear about this too often, is we denied them the use of the Panama Canal. And I've often thought, what if somebody denied us the use of the Panama Canal? Do you think that would send us into apoplectic retribution? I think it might. At any rate, getting back to it, following a little bit more from the Romans, in all of these espionage matter, there's a key question. And the key question in Latin is sui bono. Who benefits from all this stuff? And the answer was made abundantly clear in a little different context by Winston Churchill in 1931 when he wrote The World Crisis. And he penned these words: "There are many kinds of maneuvers in war, some only of which take place on the battlefield.
Right.
The new maneuver which brings an ally into the field is as serviceable as that which wins a great battle." Well, amen. And, of course, those words could just as easily have been written by Joe Stalin himself. Here's why all this is important. Cordell Hull's memorandum of November 26, 1941, often referred to as an ultimatum, but you don't have to if you don't want to. You can just call it an American note. Effectively told Japan to get out of China or else. Japan had been fighting a war in China for 4 years. And the idea that they could just pull up and leave would have led to civil war in Japan. So that was pretty much out of the question. But at any rate, they went and sent this document, which told Japan to get out of China or else. And the document was styled by the Army Pearl Harbor Board in 1944 when they put all of this together, and they called it the document that touched the button that started the war. Well, of course, what we now know is that it was written in the first two iterations by Soviet spy Harry Dexter White on June 6, 1941. That's the first memorandum. And it was written after a May meeting at the old Ebbets Grill with Vitaly Pavlov. And Vitaly Pavlov actually giving Harry Dexter White instructions as to what the Soviets wanted American foreign policy to be vis-a-vis Japan. In other words, hard line, get out of China or else. Whatever it would take for Japan to think of moving south and not moving north. Well, of course, that's precisely what Harry Dexter White recommended in his June 6, 1941 memo. Well, not too many people paid attention to it at that time. But then, November, the call again went to Harry Dexter White for how to handle American foreign policy vis-a-vis Japan. Should we send them a modus vivendi, meaning a cooling off period for 90 days where both sides agree to do nothing for 90 days. That was going to be the prevailing foreign policy. But it was suddenly changed, and the reasons it was suddenly changed are certainly up for debate. But a reason, undeniably, is that at the 11th hour, November 17th, 1941, Harry Dexter White wrote a second memorandum urging a hard line against Japan, and he ghost wrote a letter from Morgenthau to President Roosevelt with a copy to Secretary of State Cordell Hull. And that suddenly turned over the idea of a modus vivendi, a cooling off period for 90 days, and it suddenly resulted in this hardline memorandum, which was Cordell Hull's November 26, 1941 memorandum, which was styled as the document that touched the button that started the war. A very interesting idea about all of this is the Joint Congressional Committee had no idea of any of this. Harry Dexter White, completely unknown to the Joint Congressional Committee, to all of the nine.
Could I just interrupt for a minute, Tom, because I don't want to lose the thought. That memorandum, okay, did it have a completion? Get out of China or else what? What would happen?
Well,
what would the United States do?
Well, that's my styling of it. Let me...
because I want to get the whole context of it and how just hot on to war some of these characters were, unbeknownst to the American people. And
okay, well,
no, that's a vital thing.
Yeah, I'm trying to get you the actual...
Yeah, pardon me for doing that, but I think it's important to understand what was this extortion all about. I mean, this was a threat. If you don't get out, we'll come in, or we'll start a revolution within, because agents within, as you said, were ready
to begin a domestic
upheaval. Go ahead,
Rick. It's a lengthy memorandum, but in the I compare the three notes: the memorandum of June 6th, of November 17th, and then of November 26th. And in pertinent part, here's what Harry Dexter White's first memo looked like after his meeting with Pavlov. And again, this is in pertinent part because it goes on for several pages. On its part, the Japanese government proposes to do the following. One, withdraw all military, naval, air police forces from China, boundaries as of 1931 from Indochina and from Thailand. Withdraw all support, military, political, or economic from any government in China other than that of the national government. Okay? That's the June 6th one. November 17th. On its part, the Japanese government proposes to do the following. Withdraw all military, naval, air police forces from China, boundaries as of 1931 from Indochina and from Thailand. Withdraw all support, military, political, or economic from any government in China other than that of the national government. And here is what Hull's note looked like after receiving White's second memo discarding the proposed modus vivendi or 90-day cooling off period. The government of Japan will withdraw all military, naval, air, and police forces from China and from Indochina. The government of the United States and the government of Japan will not support militarily, politically, economically, any government in China other than the national government of the Republic of China. Now, it's pretty clear that Secretary Hull has adopted Harry Dexter White's language almost to the letter.
Yeah, and it hadn't yet been the People's Republic of China, I might add, too. That came after the war. But
keep in mind, this is the fifth ultimatum that we've sent to China. I'm sorry, to Japan. And, of course, Japan's not sending us any ultimatum until they finally give us the December 6th 14-part note. That's an ultimatum. But Japan, they backed up what they were going to say and did it.
All right, so we're back in December now, right? Just the day, is this the day before Pearl Harbor, December 7th, where we're talking about?
November 26th, 1941 is generally considered the date that Japan finally made their decision almost irrevocably that they were going to attack when they got this note. They were delaying things. They set up a deadline, but they were delaying. They delayed their initial deadline from the 25th to the 29th of November. And they did that waiting for Secretary of Hull's note. And when they got Secretary of Hull, Secretary Hull's note, then they proceeded with their attack plan. Very interestingly to me, anyway, is that Harry Dexter White was identified as a Soviet spy by Whitaker Chambers in 1939.
Eyewitness. That was the book.
In Witness, Chambers identifies Harry Dexter White as part of his espionage apparatus, but wrote that he did not remember telling Adolph Burrell, who was J. Edgar Hoover's counterpart in the Department of State. Chambers gave a list of people that he knew were Soviet spies. But he couldn't remember if he gave Burl the list with the name of Harry Dexter White on it or not. The fellow who was squiring Chambers around, Isaac Don Levine, was a journalist who actually had collaborated with Soviet spy defector Walter Kravitsky. That led to a further collaboration with Soviet spy defector Whitaker Chambers. Levine was trying to alert U.S. officials to Kravitsky's report that Stalin would join Hitler and predicted the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact of August 1939. Mm-hmm. He next tried to alert officials, and by he, I'm talking Isaac Don Levine, he next tried to alert officials to Chambers' information about Soviet espionage in the United States. So, at any rate, we go back to 1939 when Harry Dexter White is first mentioned as a Soviet spy. This caused, and this is to me terribly interesting, this caused J. Edgar Hoover great angst. And in 1948, a memorandum from his assistant director, Mickey Ladd, to the director. Ladd is asking J. Edgar Hoover, do I understand correctly that Chambers talked to Burl, again, the head of security for the Department of State, in 1939, mm-hmm. and we interviewed him in May of 1942, and Burl gave us information first in June 43. How did we come to contact Chambers in 1942, and did we take any investigative action then? What did we do in the year from May 42 to June 43 mm-hmm. about the data received from Chambers? Mm-hmm. And why did we not interview Chambers sooner than May 1942? That was all a question that Hoover had for Ladd. And Ladd responds by saying, this investigative delinquency was a reflection of the general investigative delinquency in the field, that's the FBI field, during the period prior to and subsequent to Pearl Harbor. Hoover noted on the memo that we should learn from this instance and not have a recurrence. Isaac Don Levine was named in the memo.
Well, also at this point, I might add, too, wasn't the State Department one of the very top vestiges of Soviet spy apparatus in the United States during those years?
Yeah, we'll get to a big list of them in just a minute, but I have one more thing to say about America. Note, because it's terribly important in the Pearl Harbor story and as it relates to Admiral Kimmel, and that is this. On November 5th, 1941, both Marshall, the head of the Army, and Stark, the head of the Navy, wrote a joint memorandum to President Roosevelt in which they said that the Chief of Naval Operations and the Chief of Staff are in accord in the following conclusions: that war between the United States and Japan should be avoided while building up defensive forces in the Far East until such time as Japan attacks. Specifically, we recommend to you, President Roosevelt, that no ultimatum be delivered to Japan. Well, obviously, Roosevelt ignored the advice from the head of his Army and the head of his Navy. But they sent this information, this November 5th joint memo to Roosevelt. They sent a copy of it to Kimmel out in Hawaii. They sent it on November 14th. Kimmel received it on November 20th. Well, that would certainly seem, in Kimmel's view, that he's being kept apprised of what's going on. But what was never conveyed to Kimmel was that FDR ignored Marshall and Stark's advice and sent an ultimatum to Japan on November 26, 1941, affirmatively misleading Kimmel again. There are other affirmative lapses here where Kimmel was denied information that he certainly should have had. But this is a beaut. He had been promised on multiple occasions that he would be sent all the information that bore upon his problem in the Pacific. Accordingly, he thought he was receiving such information, and he wasn't. Marshall went so far as to testify to the Joint Congressional Committee that if the proposed 90-day truce, the Modus Vivendi, had been effected, the United States might never have become involved in World War II at all. But a delay by the Japanese from December 41 to January 42 might have resulted in a change of Japanese opinion as to the wisdom of the attack because of the collapse of the German front before Moscow, December 1941.
Indeed. Oh, so much here, folks. We'll come right back, Tom. We got a break, and we'll return.
There's an ongoing war right here in America. Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
When your doctor tells you you have bad cholesterol or blockages in the arteries, what do you do? When diet and exercise is not enough, we try medications and hope for the best. For the last two decades, I have been telling people about a natural method to help solve these problems and more. Extendovite can help maintain cardiovascular health and lower blood lipid levels in adults. The seven herbs in Extendovite are known to work together synergistically to get the results we hope for. There are many testimonials on Extendovite's effect on circulatory-related ailments. Get Extendovite today to start your journey back to a healthier life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or see us on amazon.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
What have you done? Thousands of years of building and rebuilding, creating and recreating so you can let it crumble to dust. A million years, the sensitive men dying for their dreams. For what? So you can swim and dance and play.
All right, folks, we're back again. I hope you're all digging in here, getting a great deal of knowledge. It's important that we know this. We're speaking with Tom K. Kimmel, who is the grandson of the late Admiral husband, E. Kimmel, who along with General Walter Short, head of the Army at Pearl Harbor, were both railroaded, deliberately scapegoats for the Roosevelt administration and those who were puppeteering America into the war. And it's a shame, it's a dishonor, it's an absolute disgrace and stain on American history, and it has yet to be fully vindicated on the part of these two gentlemen. So anyway, we're talking with Tom, and Tom has a wealth of knowledge before, so I don't want to hinder you, Tom, from continuing. The only thing I would add is this right now, and I could add a few other things, is, you know, when Roosevelt first was installed in 1933 as president, he began to come under some media scrutiny, some honest people in the field, and others, you know, just in general, were questioning all of these associates of his. You remember reading about it? This one was a communist, that one was a communist, this one was a Soviet apologist. And you know what Roosevelt quirked? He came back and quirked, "Some of my best friends are communists." In a very, you know, if you looked at his face when he was saying it from the newsreels, you know, you'd say this guy was one sick and smooth, velvety politician who knew exactly every word that he was saying, a calculated word. And I should know, Tom, because I'm going to make a confession right now. No, I didn't vote for Roosevelt. I wasn't around then. But I actually played Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or Fraudulent Deficit Roosevelt, as some would call it, in a high school play on the film, which became a movie in 1960. It was Sunrise at Campobello, I believe it was. So I'm sorry, but I have to make that confession. But anyway, didn't Roosevelt say that? Didn't he admit that some of his best friends had been communists?
Oh, yeah, he most certainly did. Well, the best I can do is I did a church play, Kiss Me, Kate, and I was Kate's dad.
The church play, that became a movie, too. Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. I'm going to finish up with Harry Dexter White, and then I'm going to go to Harry Hopkins. But there's still quite a bit left of Harry Dexter White, because of all the influencers in the Pearl Harbor saga, Harry Dexter White's got to be number one.
All right. We're going to have the top of the hour break in just a moment, so just be prepared for that.
Okay. Well, I'll be ready. This has to do with the fact that the ultimatum, the American note of November 26, 1941, was never sent to Kimmel or given him any indication of what it was about, what it meant. Actually, he was given the idea that it wouldn't be sent, that no ultimatum would be sent. But it was.
Well, here's the break, Tom. We got the music, so you just stay where you are, and we'll come right back to that. And folks, you're listening to Rick Adams Uncensored on Republic. We'll return with Tom Kimmel in just a couple.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.